a human being is able to see through the chaos of the world into the very throne room of God. And what does he see? Well, chapter 4, he sees a throne. Verse 2 of chapter 4, I saw a throne in heaven and one seated on the throne. We looked last week and saw that heaven essentially is a throne room. That's what heaven's like. It's a throne room. And round the throne where God is sat, obviously, there are different kind of angels and angelic beings. But essentially, it's like the throne room at Buckingham Palace. And last week, John spent a lot of time setting the scene. But this week, what he does is he tells us what heaven's up to. What is God actually up to? If you look around at the world now, you might think, well, actually, I can't discern much of a purpose to God's actions. Perhaps you're not a Christian. We hope people come along each week who aren't believers, who've got plenty of questions about the Christian faith. And it may well be that if you're not a Christian, you look at the world and think, well, if God's up to anything, it's pretty hidden. The world is full of wars and famines. There are natural disasters. There is sort of human-caused suffering with people being evil to one another on a scale almost unimaginable. Even in my own little life, your world may be pretty chaotic. I guess not many of us are suffering sort of from genocide and war and all the rest. But people get ill and die. People mistreat us at work. The world is not running as you'd think a sort of good and holy and just God would want it to run. So what's he doing? They're very much the questions too, not just asked by people who aren't believers, but by people who are Christians. Back at the beginning of Revelation, there are a series of seven letters written to churches, and they're some of the easiest parts of Revelation to understand. And certainly for the Christians living in the days John wrote, probably in the sort of 60s, so about 30 years after Jesus, life was carnage. Emperors were putting them to death. They were being thrown to the lions, burnt alive. False teachers were getting into the church and leading them astray. So even when they turned up at church, they couldn't be sure that what they would be hearing was the truth from God. Life was hard. What's God doing? Chapter 5 was written and given to the church to reassure them that behind the chaos, even when everything looked like it might be falling apart, God still had a firm grip on them. We saw last week that God's in control of the world in general. Chapter 5 sort of hones things down a bit, focuses a bit more, and lets us know that God is in complete control of your salvation. God is in complete control of your salvation if you're one of his people. We see at the beginning, 5:1, we see a scroll. I saw in the right hand of him who is seated on the throne, so the right hand of God, a scroll written. Within and on the back, sealed with seven seals. A scroll written on both sides and rolled up. What's this scroll? Well, very simply, the scroll is God's plan for the world. Okay, we're going to see that in the next chapter. It is God's plan for the world. That's why it's written on the front and the back. Okay, it is detailed. God isn't like you and me. We sit here and we have to sort of try and make educated guesses about what the future will be like. We think we can tell what's going on. So people make guesses about the result of football matches. They look at the players, they see who's playing, and they think, well, I think Man United are better than Stoke, so I'll put my money on Man United. Other people gamble on the stock markets. I think that company's going to make a fortune, so I'll risk investing some money in it. But we're always guessing. God doesn't have to do that. It's not just that God can see the future, it's that God's in complete control of it. Complete control of the future. He's already written it down. If you like, he has got a history book in his hand that started, well, whenever he created the world, and runs through to the day when Jesus comes back, and it is already written down. Everything, every detail written down by God. It is his plan for the world. Now, we know the end of the story because he tells us it. At the end of Revelation, Jesus comes back and creates a fantastic new world where Jesus is glorified, God is praised, and that there are thousands upon thousands of people sort of stood in heaven with the angels praising him. At the end of the world, it comes a day when earth becomes like heaven. Earth becomes a place where God is praised. Earth becomes holy like heaven is holy. Earth is a place where God's rule is really easily seen rather than sort of rather murkily seen as it is at the moment. That's the end of the plan. But in between, he's mapped out each step of the way. It'll involve two things, two parts, this plan. We see these in chapter 6. If you see the scroll in verse 1, it's got seven seals. In chapter 6, the seals are opened by the Lamb, by Jesus, as we'll look at in a minute. What happens as these seals are opened, as the scroll is put into action, as it were? Two things happen. Well, the first thing that happens is thousands upon thousands of people are saved. That's chapter 7. Even if you just look at the titles given by the editors of the Bible of chapter 7 over the page. 144,000 of Israel sealed. We'll come back to why that number, but a lot of Jewish people sealed. And then the next little title, just above verse 9, a great multitude. Verse 9, I looked and behold, a great multitude that no one could number from every nation and tribe and people and language standing before the throne of the Lamb. Part of this plan is going to revolve saving so many people you can't even count them. That's part of the plan that God has written. But we need to read the whole scroll. And the other part of the plan is actually, well, it's a little bit harder to swallow. Now look what happens in chapter 6 when this scroll starts being put into action. Chapter 6 and verse 1. I watched when the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures say with a voice like thunder, come, and I looked, and behold, a horse. Its rider had a bow, a crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come, and out came another horse, bright red. Its rider was permitted to take peace from the earth, so that people should slay one another, and he was given a great sword. The first four seals, at the very least, of these seven, a good part of the scroll, is not exactly about God rescuing people. It's actually about God judging people. You see, God's in control of that as well. And this is where we start maybe feeling a bit more uneasy, but it's just a clear-as-day fact in the Bible. It is because Jesus is putting this scroll into action that, well, verse 4, people start slaying one another. On we could go and we see various other problems, famine and death and all sorts. The point is, at least for now, we'll come back to chapter 6 next week, but at least for now, the point is that God's plan involves not just the sort of salvation of some people, but also the defeating of his enemies. For Jesus to rule, what will have to happen? Some people have to bow the knee voluntarily. He will win some people over. He'll be full of joy to go to heaven. But others will refuse, and he'll conquer them. And Jesus isn't a sort of soft, gentle type figure. He is a conquering king. This plan written by God, written so that it can't be changed, involves both salvation and judgment. But it still needs putting into action. And that's the second thing that happens in this chapter. There's a problem in verse 2. I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals? And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep, says John, because no one was found worthy to open the scroll. There's no one worthy to put this plan into action. And notice God can't do it on his own. God the Father, that is, can't do it on his own. He needs an executor, someone to come and actually put it into action. And they can't find anybody. They get a massive angel, a mighty strong angel who can boom across the whole universe. Who can do this? Who can put this plan of rescuing people and conquering people into action? And no one is able. And that is why John cries in verse 5. That is why he cries. He cries because, of course, he wants people being rescued. He's a follower of Jesus. He wants thousands of people to be rescued. And he's crying because he can't see how it's going to happen. But he's also crying because, well, there's no judgment. Now, that might seem strange. Why would you cry because not enough people are being judged? John does. I guess in our setting, it perhaps harder to tell. But just imagine you were a Christian nowadays, and you were a Christian in somewhere like Syria, or somewhere like China, North Korea, where actually your brothers and sisters are being slaughtered for believing in Jesus. Wouldn't you be praying that the enemies get taken out? You probably would. Now, there are plenty of people through history who have been such oppressors of the church, such enemies to the church, that actually it's been a perfectly reasonable prayer of Christians to God to say, Lord, get rid of this person. We want rid of the Hitlers and the Mussolinis. We want rid of those who persecute the church. For those around in the day when John wrote, the emperors, the Roman emperors, guys like Nero, you can understand. You can understand the church crying out, come and conquer, Lord. We'll look at the details more in future weeks. But it is going to be a disaster if nobody can come and rescue, and if no one can come and defeat God's enemies. But, of course, the problem is solved. Verse 5, weep no more, the Lion of the tribe of Judah is here. Who can work out this plan that's written by God? Well, the only person who can work it out is the Lamb, Jesus. He is the one who is worthy. Why is Jesus worthy? Why is he worthy? Well, verse 5, who is he? He's the Lion, first of all, the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Two pictures of Jesus in the chapter. The first is a lion. And just like in our day, the lion is a picture of strength, of royalty. Right from the first book of the Bible, Genesis, it was predicted that one day a king would come. He'd be from the tribe of Judah. Remember, Jacob had the 12 sons. If you've seen Joseph in the Technicolor Dreamcoat, it's the 12 brothers. One of those brothers, Judah, it would be from his line, from his descendants, that a king would come. And as Jacob died, in fact, he leaned on his staff and predicted something for each of the 12 sons. For Judah, it was predicted, from you, a ruler will come, the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And so the first reason Jesus is worthy to be this person who puts God's plan into action, the person who's worthy to be the co-ruler of the universe with God, is that he's the strong king. He is able, he is powerful to conquer his enemies. But actually, that's not it. He's powerful to conquer his enemies, but that doesn't actually make him worthy to put the second half of the plan into action, the plan where he actually saves people. You see, being strong and powerful is not enough to save sinners from their sin. Power is not going to do it. What is needed is something else. Verse 6. Between the throne and the four living creatures, among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain. See what happens. The angel says, look, there's the Lion of Judah. And John's looking the other way. And he turns and says, oh, where? And he looks, and what does he see? Well, he sees a lamb, as if it's slaughtered, literally. Pretty gruesome sight. Angel says, there's a lion. He looks, and he sees a lamb. The two pictures of Jesus, lion and lamb. Lion, the sort of conquering, powerful one, but lamb would remind any of those who read the Bible back in its sort of first days of the Passover sacrifices. You remember when the Israelites were coming out of Egypt and God said he's going to send the angel through Egypt and every firstborn son would die. There's God being sovereign in judgment again. It is God doing the killing. And he says to the Israelites, actually, because I'm going to come through in judgment, I'm going to send my angel through in judgment and my angel will kill all sinners, you're in trouble too. Israelites weren't a shed load better than the Egyptians, were they? They're still sinful people. Now, if the angel was just to come and judge, well, Egypt would just be full of corpses by the morning. But God provided a way out. He said to the Israelites, look, take a lamb, a perfect, unblemished lamb, and sacrifice the lamb, and put the blood above the doorposts. Back in Exodus, this story. And when the angel comes through, the angel of judgment comes through, he will see that actually something has died in the place of your firstborn son. And so when the angel comes, he passes over, that's why it's called the Passover, he passes over, just skips over the houses that have sacrificed a lamb in place of their son. See, sin leads to death. That is just an unbreakable link. If you sin, you must die, says God in his word. That means if I'm not going to die, I need something to die in my place. My sin needs paying for. God cannot. Do you know this? God cannot just forgive sin. He cannot just sit there and forgive sin. It would be wrong for him to do that. To just say, hey, don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. I mean, what would you think of a God who when Hitler died and sort of came to heaven, God looked at him and said, well, 6 million, you killed 6 million Jews, a Holocaust. You started a war that spread across the whole globe, but hey, I'm loving, forgiving, come in. Would you be impressed? No, of course you wouldn't. But actually, it's not just the sort of big sins that God can't ignore. He can't ignore any sin. Any sin is an act of rebellion against him. And in the Bible, the wages of sin is death. There is no way around it. So something or someone is going to have to die. It's going to be you or it's going to be Jesus. And that is why Jesus is worthy here to be the rescuer, the one who puts the part of the plan into action that results in millions being saved. It's not about Jesus' power so much as about the fact that he was willing, even as God's son, to become man, to come to earth, to live a sort of pretty anonymous life for 30 years, to preach for 2-3 years, but then most importantly, to be crucified bearing your sin. In the song in verse 9 that the angels sing, you were slain and by your blood you ransomed people for God. Only if Jesus' blood has been poured out on you can you be one of the people who ends up in heaven rather than one of the people who ends up facing God's wrath. Now, what we need is someone to deal with our sin. Towards the end of the Bible, chapter 21 and 22, there's a list of people who can't go to heaven. I don't know if you've ever read it. It's terrifying, actually. I mean, okay, murderers can't go, but we're kind of happy with that. I guess there's not many murderers here this afternoon. But also, people who've got any sexual immorality can't go. That's me out. Even if we think we've passed the sexual immorality test, nobody who's a liar can go. That's me again. No cowards are allowed in. You ever been a coward? None of these people, we underestimate our sins so much. None of these people can get into heaven, can be the ones praising the Lamb, unless the Lamb comes and dies in their place. That is why Jesus is worthy. He's worthy, sure, because he's a powerful lion conquering the enemies. He will defeat death. He will defeat sin. He will put down all rebellion against him. But also, he's so loving that he comes and lays down his life for his people. The Lamb and the Lion, ransoming people for heaven and from hell. What does this mean? Well, it means a couple of things. First thing it means is that God now rules the universe through Jesus. Because Jesus has come, he's come to earth, he's become human, he's lived his life, and he's ascended back to heaven. From now on, God rules the way in a different way to be ruled before Jesus came. If you've been with us on Wednesdays, you'll have begun a sort of Bible overview. We've been looking at the story of the Bible, and one of the first things we saw was that God's plan was also to have human beings ruling the world. That's why he put Adam and Eve there. And Adam was king of creation. Rule over the world, he was told. That was always the plan. The plan went wrong, we know that. Everyone sinned, everyone followed Adam. But God hasn't given up on this plan to have a human ruler. It took thousands of years, but Jesus is that ruler. And now the Lamb, Jesus, is on the throne with God next to him. Verse 6, we see him between the throne and the four living creatures, and among the elders I saw a lamb. He's basically in the same place as God was in chapter 4. God now rules through Jesus. That means if you've ever been tempted to think, look, I've heard this stuff about God being in charge, okay, God being sovereign and powerful, but frankly it's a bit scary. I don't like the thought of this sort of dictator sat up on a throne in heaven, moving us around like chess pieces. Actually, we've misunderstood God. God rules through Jesus, and Jesus has revealed the true nature of God. He's not cold and distant. Yes, he knows everything, certainly. That's the idea in verse 6, with him having seven eyes. Seven eyes is a picture of sort of knowing everything. So God knows, Jesus, who's ruling this universe, knows everything that you're going through. Your life might be turmoil. He does know about it. Okay, he's not distant. He hasn't forgotten. He hasn't not noticed. You're not too unimportant to him. Whatever your personal struggles are, he sees it. He knows it. He's also all-powerful. That's the seven horns. Horns are just a picture of strength. I think of a rhino or some sort of massively powerful animal. Jesus is all-powerful. That's the seven horns. Your situation might look out of control, but it isn't. He is powerful even over the troubles you're in. But almost more important than that, the one who's ruling is a God who's come to earth and lived through it too. He's lived through every trouble you've lived through and more. He's faced every temptation you've faced and more. He understands. He's able to sympathize. He knows what life is like. And if we're ever tempted to look at him and think, well, look, Lord, if you really loved me, you wouldn't be doing this. If you loved me, why have I lost my job? If you loved me, why am I still single when everyone else seems to be partnered up? If you loved me, why am I not earning anything? If you loved me, frankly, why isn't life just easier? You ever ask those kind of questions? Well, his answer, for now at least, is, look, I loved you enough to die for you. Jesus didn't have to do that. God wasn't obliged to come to earth and die for you. We were rebellious. We hated him. We didn't ask him to. If we've got a God who's prepared to give up heaven for us, purely out of love, then actually we can trust him with the difficult things in between. We won't often be told the answers. Who knows why some of the things happen to us in life. God doesn't often come and tell you exactly. But we can trust him because he's willing to give his life for you. Powerful, sure, but he's also the lamb slain. Now, what does this mean? Well, just three things in conclusion. The first thing it means is that we should be full of worship. The first thing is worship. These creatures, the 24 elders who are kind of angelic beings in verse 8, the four living creatures who we met in chapter 4, they fall down and sing to Christ. Each of the elders in verse 8 holds a harp. I heard a guy called Don Carson, who some of you may have heard of, speaking about this passage. And he said that we think of harps, we think of really boring songs, sort of plucking and singing sort of angelic melodies. He said, actually, in the days when this was written, harps were sort of fun instruments. And he said, you should imagine it like banjos. Okay, imagine it like banjos. I mean, if you don't like banjos, then pick something else. But it's just an instrument that gets you sort of foot tapping, gets you excited. They're full of praise. That's where we're going. Our life should be full of praise because of what he's done. He's provided a complete salvation. He hasn't asked you to contribute a little bit to it. If you are following Jesus, if you are a Christian, it is because God wrote the plan that you will be a Christian. And he wrote that plan before you decided to follow him. In fact, he wrote it before you were born. Just flick over to Revelation 13. I would see just a little bit of that plan. Revelation 13, and we'll pick it up at verse 7. Now the context here is there's a beast making war against Christians. We won't go into what it is now, but Christians are in trouble, okay? And the world is in trouble. What happens? Verse 7, it, that's the beast, was allowed to make war on the saints, God's people, and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and language and nation, and everyone who dwelt on earth will worship this beast. Everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life, the book of life of the Lamb who was slain. Basically, the division here is Christian, non-Christian. What's the difference? Well, those who are Jesus's had their name written in his book. But when did God write their name? Did he wait until they said, look, do you know what? I want to follow Jesus. I want to become a Christian, and then write their name down? Sort of confirming it, like taking a register. No. When did he write it? Verse 8. He wrote it before the foundation of the world. That's when God decided to make you a Christian. Not even before you were born, before the world was born, he decided. So that's how safe you are. He has written it. And God doesn't change his plans. He's got no rubber. Okay, he's not going to take the scroll and actually look down and think, oh, flip, well, like, I thought I was going to save John, but have you seen what he's just done, Jesus? Pass the Tipex, let's just get rid of him. No, he wrote it, he'll keep it. He will keep it. It's not, of course, that we're robots. We think of it almost like a tug of war. You know, God's one end and we're the other end of the rope. And the more God pulls, the more power you give to God, the sort of less we have. We must become robots if God's really in control. No, God and us aren't in creation together, sort of fighting for power. God is over us. He can create a world where we're responsible for our actions. We are really responsible for our actions, but he is also in complete control of them. And therefore, he takes complete responsibility for our salvation. He writes the plan, and then Jesus puts it into action. And see that in verse 9. Jesus' blood ransomed people for God. It didn't make salvation possible. It actually ransomed, it bought them back. It's very easy, I think, to fall into an understanding of the cross that says that Jesus came and died and he kind of paid for all the sin out there, just in a sort of general way. And then it's up to us. Do we want to choose to follow him or not follow him? That's not what the angels sing. The angels don't sing, "Worthy are you to take the scroll, for you were slain, so that maybe some people might be ransomed if they decide to." No, your blood actually ransomed them. When Jesus died, it was the seal on God's plan, the stamp of approval from Jesus, if you like. That was it. Job done. If you're one of the people God wrote, then your sins were paid for. And there was no way, nothing could stop you ending up amongst the redeemed in heaven. Nothing. Roman emperors, false teachers, your own sin, nothing. And that's why they worship. That's why they're full of worship. It's also why all the songs in Revelation, all the songs in heaven, are about God and Jesus. They're not about us. Now, I don't want to sort of start ranting now about modern songs, and I sound like I'm a grumpy old man. But every song, without exception, that is sung in heaven, okay, and we read about in Revelation, without exception, is about God, not about how I feel about God. Okay? At no point do the four creatures, or the 24 sort of angelic beings, or the myriads, 10,000 or 10,000 angels, sit there and sing, "God, you know, I'm full of joy, I love you so much, I'm really happy." They just don't do that. That's not wrong, okay? That's not wrong. In the Psalms, you get some Psalms that are a bit like that. But without exception, the songs are, "You are worthy, you are great, you are powerful, you are, you. Because that's what worship is. It's about the other person. It'd be strange in a marriage, wouldn't it? Or if you're in a relationship. And someone said, "What's so great about your wife?" And your answer was, "Well, what's so great about her is I feel really nice when I'm with her. And what's so great about her is that I really enjoy myself when I'm spending time with her." And I mean, just a bit funny. What's so great about her? She's beautiful, or she's funny, or she's intelligent, or she... That's worship. It should, at the very least, mean the balance of our singing reflects that of heaven. So worship is a response, so is witness. Do you see that in verse 9? Who did Christ purchase? Not just a few people, but people, every tribe and language and people and nation. The gospel goes to the ends of the earth. This will come back time and time again in Revelation. And actually, it is because God is sovereign over salvation that we should be more committed to mission. Sometimes people hear this stuff about God doing all the saving, okay, choosing people before the world began, and Jesus dying for particular people. Notice he doesn't die for everybody. Okay, if he purchased everybody, job done. The whole world saved. Hitler's going to heaven. Did Jesus die for Hitler's sins? No, of course not. Verse 8 and 9, you purchased people from every tribe, tongue, language, people, and nation. He didn't purchase every person. If Jesus paid for the sins for everybody, everyone's saved. Of course he didn't do that. Some people he passed over. It is, none of us deserved it, of course. None of us deserved being saved, but some people, for his own reasons, he passed over. But those he did die for come from all the nations. And that means that actually there are people from every nation on earth that need to hear about this. They need the gospel. And it's because we can be certain that there are people in all those nations that it's worth going. You see, if God wasn't in control, imagine God wasn't really in control. Well, actually, mission work could be a massive waste of time. You know, we go to these great missionaries of the past, or there are plenty of unreached people today. We go to an unreached people group, and we pray, "Lord, please save some people from this group." And God says, "Well, I'd love to, but it doesn't seem that they want to. So what can I do?" You know, they've got to want it, and they don't seem to want it. So, that'd be useless. If God wasn't sovereign, then prayer's useless. Mission is useless. It is because God is sovereign. Because God says, frankly, "I don't care about their free will. I'd rather win them than sort of respect some sort of system of free will. I love them too much to care about their free will." It's because he overrides their free will and makes them believe that prayer is possible, that mission is possible. The worship involves prayer. So the gold bowls full of incense in verse 8 are. God uses our prayers. Again, we're not robots. We're not sort of nothings down here on earth, just marionettes, puppets being sort of pulled around by God. No, we are real people who can really pray and really get involved. But thankfully, he is so powerful, he can override stubborn hearts. It is the confidence that God would win people from all nations that made people go out back in the great sort of missionary days, 18th, 19th centuries. The more confident you are that God is sovereign, the more likely you are to go. And finally, the more likely you are to give. Verse 12, worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power, wealth, and wisdom. Power, wealth, and wisdom. The point of giving is so worship increases. The universe is headed towards a day when everyone worships Christ, apart from those who are crushed by him as enemies. And that's why we need to give generously. Our wealth, the reason God gives you wealth is to increase worship through mission, through witness. He doesn't give you it so you can get a better and better house or a bigger and bigger car. He gives you it so that once you've provided for yourself, you can expand this amount of worship going on. Expand the number of tribes, tongues, peoples and nations who've heard the gospel and therefore have worshippers. That is what the money's for. It's not about building Christ Church or whatever. But when we give money in, we as a church then give a percentage of it away. Money and wealth is given to Christ to promote worship. The Christians that John wrote to would have been terrified about losing their salvation. The pressures from the world were on them. They knew their own hearts. They knew they were not confident enough to stand. So John writes and says, don't worry, your salvation is written by God. And God's got no tipex. And it's worked by Jesus. And Jesus has got no rivals.